Ah, good evening, everybody. We've been promising this for a while, but we are finally doing it today.
Yes.
We're getting that democratization on. Because I don't know, we've had a couple of things, a couple of streams, to get us back into it, really. And I also think that I don't know, there's some stuff that needed saying before we did this. Also, people need to catch up as well. It's been quite a big one that people have been telling me because of how just how much stuff there is to get through here. But hello, Trey. How have you been? There's some preamble.
I've been pretty good actually. It's been a good week for me actually. It's been nice. Been nice. Managing to catch up with a few things and generally just sort of chill out from the madness that has been going off for the last God knows how long. And yeah, had a nice stream with Rose yesterday. We talked about Chris Chan and all of that lot.
Oh yeah, sorry I missed that. I was babysitting actually.
No, I heard you had at uncle duties or something going off. So cool. But yeah, all in all, pretty decent this week. Just been pretty chill. Been pretty chill. What are we doing here? Well, I'm just let me just set this up. That's good. Right. It's all right. I just had to stop our stream from echoing into ourselves as I flicked over and decided
Oh
to
yeah,
watch
no, I
ourselves.
think we have to double. I have to double check we're actually live though sometimes, which is kind of it's a
Yeah.
bit of a balancing act. Ha ha, funny monkey. No. As people saw yesterday, I put out a video talking about some physical events that at least I'll be at.
Yes.
So,
Yes, you're doing the academic agent, although it's not an academic agent.
no,
It's his.
people saying it say is thing. It's actually not.
Yeah.
I'm part of the problem is it's one of the best ways to explain it, which is kind of funny.
Yes.
But no, just go. I won't talk about it lengthy. Go watch the video. It's only 5 minutes long.
I would love to go, but 300 quid seems a lot for a weekend. And at the moment, I am the big unemployed, as we all are actually at the moment. But
Yeah,
yeah.
everyone seems to be. Yeah, it's a running theme with actually people with technical skills who don't want to wash dishes. So no,
Yeah.
the UK is in a bit of trouble right now. But no, it's interesting that I'll be speaking at that event. So I'm actually getting to go for free, which is I probably wouldn't be able to go otherwise, honestly.
You're doing the whole "where do we go from here" theme as well, which is I'm kind of gutted. I'm going to miss that because that's something that I wouldn't mind doing a bit on in the future as well. Because it's all very well and good going, look at this stuff that happened in the past. This is bad, but that's great and everything. But let's how do we fix the problem from here? Is the question. And without going completely, 1605 November the 5th on everything, which is a solution, but perhaps not the one we want to go for.
No. But like I said, a big part of what we've been talking about, what we've been doing, is looking back to the past with these democratization streams, because we've gone in very great detail now from 1900, skipping over some of the early part of the 19 kind of up until 1910 really.
Yeah.
But we're going quite heavy detail from 1900 to now 1939. We are here. War were declared for those who
Yes.
enjoy watching them. Matthias
So we
and
are
CN
considering
Arsenal.
the Anschluss has happened and Germany and Austria have become one, essentially.
Yes. The
Yes.
Sudetenland has been given over. The Rhineland's been remilitarized. The Soviet Union has crept along its own borders and gobbled up a couple of countries as well. People forget about that. The Winter War is still a brewing. But yeah, basically what's happened is that both Germany and the Soviet Union, something we'll get onto because that's a point I like to hammer home to people, is that two countries invaded Poland, but one of them was supposedly our ally and blameless, and the other one was
Yes.
the Third Reich. It's kind of interesting that that was well, Hitler shouldn't have done that. He should never have invaded Poland, but the Soviets, and they got it afterwards. The Soviets
Yeah,
got it afterwards, basically as
yeah,
well.
I know. And the other thing that was happening around this time, which I've been desperately trying to find some clarification on, is that following the Anschluss of 1938, Italy went, hang on a second, this Hitler fella looks a bit warlike. I'm going to build some defensive lines across the top of it, of Italy, in case this this nasty moustache guy decides to invade my homeland, which nobody ever talks about.
We might go over it in a later stream, but there's some good stuff about the fact that Hitler and Mussolini really didn't like each other. They were allies of convenience and very much pushed into being allies by a similar ideology, and the fact that Italy felt threatened by a lot of the stuff the Allies were doing and the Western powers were doing. The Second World War politically is a lot more complex than people give it credit for.
Yes.
We only have the time to talk about relatively narrow aspects of it when it comes to our central theme of democratization.
Yes.
And really, I don't know, I don't want to say that World War II is like baby's first, like, hold on a minute, wars for democracy are kind of weird, but a lot of people's view of history, I think, starts with unraveling the glaring issues with the narrative as taught to you in high school of the Second World War, because it does very quickly, especially with the subsequent era of the Cold War, get extremely confusing. I can only imagine how confusing it was at the time to go from Uncle Joe Stalin to Reds Under the Bed in less than a decade.
Mm. Yeah, very much so. Uncle Joe Stalin, let's throw as much money and kit at him as possible, because isn't he nice? He's got a very friendly moustache. To, holy shit, communism's the worst thing ever. It really was an about turn, to say the least. Because one was McCarthyism. McCarthyism was 50s and 60s. It not far away. Yes, and going back to it, actually, fascism and National Socialism get melded together all the freaking time. And, not that I'm going to sort of say, like pro either of them. I'm fairly anti both of them, being a libertarian. I think they're a bit, authoritarian for my taste. But
the branches of socialism.
They are not the same, but yeah, exactly. No,
they're different.
I've been reading a lot of things of people going, to be honest, if things had gone differently, Mussolini's policies would have been just about fine with most of internationalism after the war. Yeah, you're right.
Well, speaking of the whole war for democracy stuff, a big thing we've been trying to keep in people's minds was the redrawing of the map of Europe by Woodrow Wilson. People talk about the Treaty of Versailles, with its reparations sowing the seeds for the First World War, but really it was Woodrow Wilson's, insistence on the reemergence of these quote-unquote free democratic states that had existed, There's the first and second kind of Polish republics and Polish nations, and there's all kinds of liquid borders when it gets to the 16th and 17th Europe. But essentially, what happened was at the end of the First World War, the Americans set the peace, and that meant the Progressive Era. Woodrow Wilson came in, drew some lines on a map, and decided that these would be some nice, free, democratic countries to have. And they would have American-style democracy. And one of the big things to talk about is territory and the amount of territory that was ceded to create these different countries. And the idea that Germany was simply reclaiming its historic territory, when you look at things like the Sudetenland, does have a large amount of merit. I mean, invading Czechoslovakia blanket? No. That was just Hitler taking advantage of the situation and what he thought he could get away with. But the idea that, the idea of Lebensraum and uniting the German-speaking people is something that comes from the territory losses. And those territory losses are a direct result of what Woodrow Wilson wanted.
Yeah, and the Northern Corridor between... My brain's gone.
Danzig.
The Danzig Corridor. Yeah, that's it. Certainly. Certainly, there was a hell of a lot of German-speaking and culturally German people in that chunk of Poland that were not doing well, actually, under the Polish, which is something that people don't like to talk about too much.
No, they don't. Again, we've been over a lot of this stuff previously. We're going to be not scantily using sources, but there's a lot of stuff we have talked about before and we have used sources for. We're really, this is... World War II is the culmination of all these eras.
Yes.
And the idea in popular history is that World War II is inevitable. That it is this inevitable struggle between good and evil. This you know, this predetermined existential fight between democracy and totalitarianism, and that democracy wins the day, and we end up with the UN and essentially world peace thereafter.
That wonderful world peace that has had us at war with various tinpot countries in the Middle East and everything else forever.
And, you know, that the Soviet Union didn't want to play ball with the UN, and they were the problem. So you ended up with, you know, the East versus West and the Cold War. That is history as popular, you know, as taught again in schools, as is written on the back of a fag packet, basically.
Yeah.
As you will get on TV. But that is not the history that we have here, and that is not the history that we will be talking about here. But it's very important, really, to untangle that first of all, because it's so ingrained in people's minds. It's so ingrained in my mind. It's what you've been taught from being a child if you were raised in Western Europe or America or large parts of the rest of the world as well.
There was a very famous quote, and it's the Americans, I think it was either an American general or the American president, to Churchill when they were at the victory parade in Russia when the IS-3 tank was unveiled. And they literally sort of sat down and went, oh, Jesus Christ, we backed the wrong guy. literally almost on the spot when they sort of saw the Russian military might marching down in the night. I think it was 1946. they had a very nasty shock. But yes, we need to wind back to the beginnings of it all. And shall we start with Ralph Rako's... Ralph
Rako here, who we keep nicking bits from.
Yes.
This is, again, from Great Wars and Great Leaders, a libertarian rebuttal. Great Wars and Great Leaders is a great book. Ralph Rako has done quite a lot of good stuff. But it's the reason that we use the Mises website so much is that there's so many good pieces of this here. There's a section, it's a little bit far down the page, but it says Where Wilson Had Promised. I don't know if you want to read from that or should I, but...
you know what? You start, because I'm going to find it.
Yeah, Wilson had promised, if you control that. Yeah, Wilson had promised, and the Allies had agreed, that self-determination would serve as the cornerstone of the new world order of justice and peace. It was this prospect that had produced a surge of hope throughout the Western world as the peace conference began. Yet there was no agreement amongst the victors on the desirability of self-determination, or even its meaning. George Clemenceau, the French premier, rejected it as applied to the Germans, and aimed to set up the Rhineland as a separate state. The British were embarrassed by the principle, since it had no intention of applying it to Cyprus, India, Egypt, or Ireland. Even Wilson's Secretary of State could not abide it. Lansing pointed out that both the United States and Canada had flagrantly violated the sanctity of self-determination in regard to the Confederacy of Quebec, respectively. Wilson himself had little understanding of what this doctrine implied. As the conference progressed, the president, buffeted by grimly determined Clemenceau and the clever British Premier George, David Lloyd George, I almost said George Floyd there, in a series of contravention of self-determination that at the end had been a farce of its own lofty, if ambiguous principle.
So Wilson was talking tosh. What a surprise. Yeah. Uh-huh. There we go. So we're going to carry on. Yeah. Wilson had declared...
Just quickly. It says, Wilson had declared... that national groups must be given the utmost satisfaction that they can be accorded to them without introducing new or perpetuating old elements of discord and antagonism. At Paris, Italy was given the Brenner Pass as its northern frontier, placing nearly 250,000 Austrian Germans in South Tyrol under Italian control. The German city of Memel was given to Lithuania, and the creation of the Polish corridor to the Baltic and the free city of Danzig, under what you're talking about, the Polish control, affects another 1.5 million Germans. The Tsar region was handed over to France for at least 15 years. Altogether, some 13.5 million Germans were separated from the Reich. The worst cases of all were Austria and the Sudetenland. It goes on to talk about the fact that Anschluss was voted for by 98 and 95% respectively, but Anschluss was forbidden under the treaty. Basically, it says... as we know, that Germany was the country that was allowed least self-determination, and that in creating these free states and reseeding this territory, they really did separate Germans from Germany. And because of World War One, those Germans were quite often afforded lower economic opportunities or were outright persecuted. That is a matter of historical fact. Yeah. And that is one of the reasons why Hitler was so popular and embraced.
Well, this is it. I mean, this is what I was talking about when I wasn't the last one. Was it the last one we did? Well, I was actually reading from Mein Kampf after having read. Well,
Totalitarian State. That was the one before the last one.
Yeah. Three quarters of that book, and you actually, you know what? The first chunk of it, you get a feel for you know, Adolf Hitler and why he was. Why he considered himself to be a German nationalist when everyone does. Oh, he was an Austrian. Well, ish. And his understanding of nationalism and certainly what these treaties had done, which was butcher Germany into huge amounts of little pieces, and lots of bits of Germany were sort of portioned off to Poland, Lithuania, etc., as you just said. You can understand why there would be an awful lot of bad feeling in that country towards these treaties, and why they felt hard done to, and why when Hitler comes along and goes, "No, we're gonna pull it all back, boys. We're gonna rebuild the country." Why he got so much support? Because, you know, he did get voted in democratically, so quite rousing support. And why that happened is, it was kind of set up for him almost by these, you know, butchering of the German speaking countries.
Well, there's also the fact that the Americans and the British were able to turn around and actually support Hitler as a strong man.
Yeah.
Because he was, you know, there's a wink and a nod there. He was a Keynesian. He was a big state guy. He was a guy who believed in the power of government. And a lot of people like Lloyd George went, finally, someone who can sort out what was becoming this embarrassing German mess. Because they tried to administer Germany. They tried to revamp it economically. They tried to turn it into a viable state again. And it just hadn't happened. They had essentially, in the administration of Germany and through their actions in the pursuing of reparations, also whilst going through the Dawes plan, they were basically cycling money around, as we talked about few weeks ago.
It was money in, add interest, money out, round and round, and then straight back to the people that lent stuff.
Yeah,
nightmare.
International finance, with Germany being almost held as a vassal state, embarrassed itself in the 1920s and 30s. It was one of the major contributing factors to the Great Depression.
Yep.
Because a lot of American banks especially were leveraging their, you know, the debt they were owed from the war against debt incurred by Germany and reinvesting in Germany. They were throwing leveraged debt after bad money. It was insane, the situation. It's insane that's not talked about more. But that, again, that is the situation we find ourselves in the beginning of World War II. You can say that the lofty ambitions of self-determined democracy and the creations of these new states, but also the caveat violations that they would rob Germany of as much territory as a defeated power as possible, was the real cause. I mean, a lot of the ceding of territory, I don't think we have time to read it all here, but was covered up by plebiscite. You know, they basically got together, they gerrymandered some of these elections very heavily, and they got a large non-German area and a small German area and got them all to vote about, you know, which country they wanted to be in.
Yeah, it was... Yeah. We just had a super chat, didn't we? Not super chat.
Yeah, yes, we did. It was, thank you, that was Plasma Rob. He donated $10.
Thank you,
said,
Plasma.
I got a job and I'm a man of my word. And Scrump, let me know if you still need any editing help. All right, okay, that's good. Yes, I will send you something, Plasma Rob. Thank you for getting back to me, because I know you've been looking for employment for a little bit there. So that's good shit. Thank you for the $10, my
dude. And good news about your job. Thank you. That's awesome.
Yes,
well done. Yeah, sorry, I nipped downstairs and made a coffee because I don't have anyone here to make me coffees and cups of tea. And
right.
I suddenly thought, right, whilst we're talking about this, I'll sneak downstairs and quickly knock a coffee together, because I've been running a little late this afternoon. I was watching Evelyn's stream earlier.
That was pretty good.
It was good. It was with
Who was it with? I keep forgetting.
The jolly something or other. Oh God! Now you're making me.
Yeah. I'm having a brain dead moment too. But if you go on, it's linked down below. If you go on Evelyn's Twitter, the DG115511.
It should jolly, be on there. The Jolly Heretic, that's it.
Yes, 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 that's the guy. But Mechanical Foreigner in chat says, so Hitler was our guy? Actually, very much so, yes. Hitler and Stalin were embraced by the West in the 20s and 30s. One, for their, you know, supposedly heroic reactions to the Great Depression, and two, because they were seen as these modern leaders of scientific new states.
Yes.
You know, socialism especially was seen as the forefront scientific technology-based ideology of the 20th century. It was very in vogue, especially with the high society, especially with people like Wall Street. You might think, you know, we've talked about that, but a lot of the people at the very the apex of Wall Street were socialists. They saw it as one of benefits to them and too fashionable.
Yeah, I want to see the threads of Wall Street to China in the Second World War as well. I'm fairly certain they're there in great amounts.
Oh, the most obvious one was the Dixie Mission, which has a huge amount of mud thrown up about it because it came at one of the pivot points. We can talk about it probably. I actually do want to talk about it when we do 1945 to 1950.
Yeah.
But the Dixie Mission is a fascinating example of the breakneck pivot in the invention of the USSR as the enemy and containment and all that.
Yeah, of course it was. I mean,
Sealgear, do you think people confuse scientific advancement and social progression? Yes, I very much do. You start to, it's more in the 1950s, but you start to see coming out of this modern era, the invention of the social sciences. That's really where a lot of this comes from. A lot of the Nazi and Soviet pseudoscience very much bears the hallmarks of prototype social science.
Another super chat, not super chat. Thank you.
Merc donated $10 there, but I'm going to respect his wishes and not read the message.
Yes.
And that's $5 from Kiwi there saying, do you have any intent to cover the USSR's adoption of Spanish Civil War refugee children in efforts to turn them into perfect Soviets? That's something I'm aware of, but frankly, that's, unfortunately, that's a bit off in the weeds for this episode.
Yeah. Yeah, though if you tell you what, if you've got documentation of it, send it over to either one of us on Twitter or whatever. I would love to look into it.
But yeah, in the vein of Hitler being quote unquote our guy, that's a great lead into the next topic.
it's not bad, not a bad one. Hold on, sorry. The old Hitler and Stalin as extensions of Western policies. Not a bad segue, actually, though, yeah. Yeah. And even the old lean in towards Stalin. Look at the angles on that picture.
Yeah. Yeah, that's some... You need some lines drawn. Have you seen the meme where they draw lines on people and talk about their attitudes? That's very much needed there.
He's only an inch away from putting the old arm around his shoulder, almost. Good old Uncle Joe.
Uncle Joe. Again, we talked about that in the totalitarian special, but yes, the rhetoric of Uncle Joe is very incongruous in this area. We'll see some propaganda about that. But as we have established through our reading of Sutton before, and Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, and Wall Street and the Bolsheviks, and Wall Street and FDR, that really, FDR, Hitler, and Stalin are all products of the Western financial elite and therefore their ruling of Western foreign policy.
Yeah, no doubt about it. They were having money thrown at them and yeah. I mean, Mr. I've met Mr. Hitler and he seems like a terribly nice chap. That wasn't Chamberlain.
That was Lloyd George.
It was Lloyd George, wasn't it? Yeah. Yeah.
It was specifically called I Spoke to Hitler.
Yes, they... Whether they saw it coming, whether they... I don't know. Whether it was all... was it intentional? That's the real question.
The thing is, it doesn't have to be orchestrated because We'll talk about it next time because there's a good book about it. But Stalin definitely wanted a war. He had been like chomping at the bit for one.
Yeah.
For basically the last 5 years, because he knew it would be a great excuse to expand, you know, to really use his stranglehold on the Soviet state. And it did turn him for a while into a hero. With FDR. FDR wanted a war because he saw it as one of the only ways to, you know, be able to get past some of the, you know, we talked about war economies and the logjam of democracy and the way that modern people talk about war economies in that in an almost hungry term, because it allows them to just piss all over property rights. That's what FDR wanted the war for. He wanted the war to basically turn it into the ultimate New Deal. And Hitler wanted the war because, what else, you know, that's really the subsummation of, like, what else they're going to do? They're burning through all their money. They've essentially done the Keynesian equivalent of setting Germany on fire to keep their hands warm. That's what the, you know, that's what the Nazi economic miracle was. It was just turbo MMT. And in the short term, you get, you know, an illusionary boost. But they had to go to war to keep their economy going and to keep their society together. So all of these, you know, what Mises would describe as total states, have war in their own interest because it allows them to expand their power and also completely short-circuit any debate about the fact that they've managed to essentially create the biggest states in history.
Oh, an American president that wanted to shit all over property rights. It's unheard of these days.
But there's actually a passage in Sutton here, which I've saved because it is the spiciest passage, I think, in Sutton. It's wonderful.
Let's slap that over there. There we go. In fact, let's see if I can't just make that a little... a little better on the screen. There we go. Yeah, there we go. So several basic observations can be made from this evidence. First, the Board of American IG had three directors from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the most influential of the various Federal Reserve Banks. American IG also had interlocks with Standard Oil of New Jersey, Ford Motor Company, the Bank of Manhattan, later to become Chase Manhattan, and AEG, German General Electric. Second, three members of the board of this American IG were found guilty at the Nuremberg war crimes trials. These were the German, not the American members. These Germans, Max Igner, a director of IG Farben, NW7 office in Berlin, i.e. Nazi pre-war intelligence office. If the directors of a corporation are collectively responsible for the activities of the corporation, then the American directors should also have been placed on trial at Nuremberg, along with the German directors. That is, if the purpose of the trials was to determine war guilt. Of course, if the purpose of the trials had been to divert attention away from the US involvement in Hitler's Reichsbau, they succeeded very well in such an objective.
But basically, Sutton low-key calls the Nuremberg trials an act of political theatre that does not punish the right people, which I think is both an astute observation and one of the most base historical things you can say about World War II.
I mean, there was an awful lot of this, you know, Fritz here stood on a guard post. And if he hadn't, he'd have been shot, but, you know, nevertheless, he must burn. Meanwhile, the directors of people who were involved directly and were funding things were walking away.
That's IG Farben, by the way, we're talking about. IG Farben, if you don't know, was one of the, it was basically the main conglomerate of German war machine. It made a lot of the chemical weapons. IG Farben also, it famously is supposed to have made the Zyklon B that was in the gas chambers. So we're talking about, you know, IG Farben is recorded in history and seen in history as basically the most evil corporation that's ever existed. You know, at least in some ways. You know, at least within, you know, the classical telling of history. So what he's basically saying is that if their version of history is correct and these people were war criminals, why weren't the American directors of the same company also charged? surely if they, you know, if they are all culpable, if, you know, if they run the corporation, why was there no culpability for the non-German directors? It's a very good question.
I mean, it's changed names and types, and but there are, yes, there we are. Zyklon B was created by IG Farben. Yep. You're quite right, but there are still strands of it still in existence. It was liquidated. It turned into BASF and Bayer and
yes.
all sorts of other companies. You know, it's not dead. It's just, you know, oh, we'll scratch a line through that name and we'll give it another name. And so, you know, when you got your Bayer products, which are every freaking where, they're the guys that made Zyklon B. So it's still IG Farben. It's still the same thing. Same people, essentially. Well, same history. I get myself in trouble saying things like that, but yes, members of the board, shall we say, did join the when it was liquidated. Other boards that, yeah, mind you, you could easily say that if that were the case, that that NASA seemed to be run by Nazi scientists. That couldn't possibly be the truth. But we, I digress slightly. But yes, IG Farben, certainly the if a company is responsible for its actions and the directors are the head of that company, then to prosecute some directors and not all of them seems disingenuous. Well, it's just like how they rename the Lords to the Commons. Yes. Yes, kind of.
Although, well, it's basically a wink and a nod that they knew what they were doing. You know, fair enough, if American companies had partaken in the war effort without really the knowledge or the permission of the American administration, and they come back afterwards and said, holy shit, what did Wall Street do? We're going to punish you. But the fact that they so brazenly ignored the very obvious involvement of the American arm of IG Farben is really, it's a smoking gun that they knew what they were doing and they knew what had been done throughout this process. There was not a restorative kind of justice aspect of the American funding and involvement in the Third Reich because it was part of the plan. They knew what they were doing and they didn't care.
Yeah, of course they didn't care. I mean, you'd got organizations like Ford and like General Electric and General Motors who had factories or subsidiary factories in Germany giving Bomber Command and the sort of American bomber, strategic bomber sort of command, targeting details and saying, please do not hit these buildings because those are our buildings. You can blow up those factories over there. Blow up those tank factories, but don't blow up ours because, you know, we're an international company that has a lot of money in your country too.
Thank you for the donations there, Glowy. Ooh. There's a $3 follow donation.
Thank you.
It's in my opinion, the world powers are trying to do what they are doing in China now. Ignore the bad acts for economic gains. Yeah, the same thing will happen again for a world war. Like I said, it is the same. It's the same way China is viewed now in some ways, in that suspiciously, but you know, they're still our allies technically on paper, and we still definitely want to trade with them. And I think in a generation, possibly, the enabling of China's multiple genocides by the West will be viewed as abhorrent as the standing by during the Stalin era. But, you know, we're in our contemporary time now, and a lot of people can't move outside of it. But yeah, it will be the same. The amnesia will take over. People will move on and go, wow, how did anybody ever allow that to happen? But we're living through it right now. You are literally living through an experience of how people allowed, you know, things like Stalin's purges to take place without taking action. And also whilst being an ally of Stalin.
Here's the realization. The realization is, this has always happened. Nobody at the high end, at the top end, gives a flying toss about the humanitarian reasons for going to war in the actual facts. And it's always something far more insidious, like, you know, the movement of small green pieces of paper, than the actual protection of human rights and human beings who you know, are being butchered by countries. No, it's wealth, it's money, it's gold, it's, you know, politics as well. It's ideology. It's never, oh, look, they're massacring this bunch of people, let's go and save them. Never. Never happened. They might say that. They might say that to the general populace. But, I mean, it's like, yeah, like I just put into chat, IBM is another one. IBM put the machines to document goods in and out into Auschwitz-Birkenau. And I know that because I've been there. Has IBM ever been held to account for their help that they gave the Nazi regime? Never. Nobody would ever say a word to them. No one would say boo to a goose. And I guarantee you, actually, if you wanted to know what the actual goods in and out was going off into places like Auschwitz, IBM will probably have the records buried away somewhere that they would never fucking release.
Well, there's an article here as well from Mises Wire, which is a little bit, I don't know, it's a little bit unfocused, but there's a little bit here about Reiko and him talking about the fact that Lend-Lease was one of the great expansions of American presidential power. But it's a guy called T. Hunt Tooley. It's a slightly older one of the Mises articles, I think. Oh, it's from 2016. It's not that old. But he's lamenting here the fact that the historical narrative was written long, you know, it cemented in people's minds before people really were told to think about the fact that both Stalin and Hitler were very similar totalitarians. And that it seems so amazing that that couldn't be part of the narrative, but it couldn't. You can't have really a vibrant, vital version of the Second World War that people think about, and, you know, that's present in their minds until, you know, and also be able to talk about the fact that Stalin was one of the most evil people who's ever lived. It really isn't until like the 80s, 90s, as it says here, that this becomes part of the discussion. And, okay, why do you think it took until the 80s and 90s for that to become part of the discussion?
Well, for a start, he was dead at that point and he couldn't hold him responsible.
Yeah. Basically, everybody who cared and who was around during the war was dead by then.
Yeah. You can't hold someone responsible when they're dead or when they're 90 and just what's that, Sonny? You know, at that point, it's not really an awful lot of point. And was Stalin the most evil? You know what? There's been a fair amount of real evil bastards in the last 100 years. Stalin was definitely amongst them, but Pol Pot and Mao. Don't get me started on the killing fields of Cambodia and the trees that they used to swing children into because they wanted to save bullets and so on. Boy. Yeah, Stalin was pretty nasty, but I still actually think he was the warm and fluffy one out of Trotsky and Lenin and Stalin. Because Lenin was a bit of a bastard. And Trotsky wanted war ongoing forever. So, yeah.
He did, yes. It starts mid-paragraph here, but there's a good passage I want to read from this Mises Wire article.
Hold on.
It starts, in essence, it's the second paragraph, kind of the middle of the second paragraph. But so I got to pick through some of the waffle here. I'm sorry, T. Dooley, but this isn't the best article on the Mises Institute. But he does make a very good point here. He says, in essence, two totalitarians agreed to divide Europe after nearly 2 years of close cooperation in invasion, mass killing, deportations, and forced labor, the two great apostles of state power parted ways, largely because their long-range territorial, strategic, and economic plans were mutually exclusive, i.e., they both wanted to rule the fucking world, and they were both still totalitarians and mass murderers. Yet this whole issue of Hitler and Stalin as two rogues of the same total state had to wait until the 80s and 90s before any hint of historical comparisons reached the mainstream, meaning college textbooks, academia, popular history, etc. Even all those years later, when specialists among mainstream historians knew very well the research on Stalin portrayed as a horrifying record, treatment of the Man of Steel in textbooks and news media almost always pulled punches. The amazing thing is that during the Cold War, educated Americans could both hold images in their minds of Uncle Joe on the one hand and an evil Cold War Stalin on the other, a truly Orwellian feat. Yeah, it's quite well summed up. It's quite amazing how they pulled that off. Well, yeah. How they were able to go from, in 5 years, the image of Uncle Joe to the image of the Snatcher of Europe. Essentially, yes. You know, the taking pot shots at the Berlin airlift.
Yes. I mean, I know we mentioned it before, but the cartoon / comic book, comic book's really the right term for it, When the Wind Blows, I'm sure you've read it, is great because they do point that out. You've got these little old couple, you know, sort of in a nuclear fallout scenario, reminiscing about the war. And, oh, Uncle Joe, wasn't he? He was ever so friendly, ever such a nice chap. And what went wrong? And that was... When was that? I think it was put together in the 70s and 80s, but it was very...
Yeah, it's 80s, yeah.
It was 80s. Yeah, it did sort of highlight that, you know, that there seemed to be a change. It's around about the 50s was the change in the feelings about communism. But as with regards Stalin, I mean, certainly I knew in the 80s we were being taught that Stalin was an absolute evil bastard. We were starting to hear some of the body count. I don't think that it was a case of every time you looked into it, the body count got revised up on how many people were dying.
When you were in history class, you still got taught about the heroes of Stalingrad.
Yes.
Which is, again, this leftover. At the end, we're going to talk about really the idea that World War II propaganda became the prevailing historiography, and you have this... real whiplash. That's really why people aren't taught the interwar years, and they aren't really taught a lot about the Cold War apart from the surface level stuff, because it doesn't make any sense. The interwar years don't make sense. People are taught really the Victorian era, they're taught World War One, World War Two, a little bit about the Cold War, and that's really kind of it when it comes to modern British history. That's how our education system works, because you can't talk about, you know, the early parts of the 1950s in Britain. You can't talk about especially anything in the 20s and 30s in Britain with all the consensus and coalition and, you know, national governments. It doesn't make any sense to people. So it's just left out.
Yeah.
And again, the changing image and changing face of the Soviet Union, you know, within our own history texts, on the one hand, having the heroes of Stalingrad, on the other hand, having, you know, the butchers of the purges, those were the same people. That was the same military. That was the same organization.
Yep.
These were the same people who carried out Stalin's orders. And it's an amazing cognitive dissonance to be held in someone's head at the same time.
I mean, there was another one, as Silger Pope points out in chat, about Churchill, about prior to the Second World War, he was considered a bit of a, you know, a mad dog rich kid, as he puts it there. Yes and no. He always had a certain amount of popularity. He was definitely... Yeah, mad dog is actually is a good term for it. He was ballsy, he was gutsy, and he did get involved in an awful lot of conflicts. He made some colossal fuck ups, excuse my language, but man, did he cost a lot of people their lives. But he spoke very, very well.
Ironically, I think in some circles he was seen as almost like a Boris Johnson figure.
Yeah, very much so. I've compared him to Boris Johnson many, many times. His rhetoric and his oratory is very similar to Boris Johnson. I think Boris Johnson actually sort of tries to play up a Churchillian type character.
It's ironic because he's become the architect of the lockdown, and Churchill became the architect of the welfare state, and then really the total state that people lived in the 20s and 30s and thereafter.
Yep.
He was essentially, he's been lionized, but he has probably done more, apart from someone like Lloyd George, to destroy the traditional British order than anyone else in history. And a lot of people celebrate that because they think that there was, you know, this rigid system of barons, but what it was replaced with this empty, soulless, pseudo-socialist state we get in the 60s and 70s that eventually, you know, we are still suffering from and leads to what we get with Thatcherism and then the resurgence of, I guess, kind of vision politics in the 90s with Blair. that's where it all leads. It leads here. And it, you know, I don't think, again, many people believe that we live in a reality in this moment that is paradise. And yet we are supposed to have made all the right moves towards it.
No, we are definitely not living in paradise at the moment. Far, far, far from it. Although there are some nice... there are some niceties. I mean, we do live better. Most average people live better than kings used to. Certainly 100 years ago, you couldn't snap your fingers and make curry arrive at your door 30 or 40 minutes later. Even if you were the king. Possibly if you were the king. But, you know, we do have a... Life at the present moment, it does have its benefits, but at the same time, the lockdown, the total state, the panopticon that the internet has given us, the fact that if someone wants to watch you and see what you're up to, they can do. The fact that we wander around bugged all the time with our mobile phones willingly. There's some madness there as well. But go on.
I'm going to say the whole point really is that Hitler and Stalin, as portrayed as butchers of history, were really the instruments of Western policy in their prospective countries. As fervently as people want to cover up the Hitler stuff, and, you know, as ambiguous people are about the Soviet Union stuff, because both Stalin's and Lenin's five-year plans were both kickstarted by Western money and technical expertise.
Yes.
There's a lot of kind of anecdotal historical evidence that Stalin really was the West's guy. He was supposed to replace Lenin, who didn't want to play ball with the West anymore.
Ah, yes, and was Lenin right in not wanting to play ball? I mean, no one forced Hitler or Stalin to be the butchers that they were. That is the point. They were certainly enabled, but man, did they run with that particular ball.
I think the point is that once you destroy a country, essentially, yeah, once you create the situation like they did with the Russian Revolution and put the Bolsheviks in power, that someone like Stalin becomes inevitable.
Yeah.
And once you end up with the Weimar Republic, the credit expansions, and then, you know, the seeming relief of the stabilizing influence of someone like Hitler, it becomes inevitable that you end up with a situation like that. Whether it would be Hitler or Stalin, the environment for them, you know, it wasn't inevitable, but it was created. And that's another point to talk about with the war. And then again, I want to talk about when we get to the end point of this, is that the Second World War, like the First World War, is something that was done to Europe. It took effort. You had to have people who wanted this to happen for it to happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the myth of it being a purely German war in both cases, again, fallen by the wayside somewhat with the First World War. But, you know, if you talk to most people and you said that the Second World War wasn't really primarily a war of German aggression, it was a war that was facilitated. You know, the Germans made the first move, but it was a war that was facilitated by the fact that basically the three biggest powers in the world, that being the emerging Third Reich, the Soviet Union, and FDR's America, all saw war as part of their self-interest.
Yeah, it was kind of necessary for what they wanted to achieve, I think. What they wanted to achieve, I don't know. It's horrendous to think, but yes, Europe was shattered by this event. It was never the same again, and America rose to huge amounts of predominance after the Second World War.
Again, we're going to do this in stages because it's a big one, but the calculation of benefits and what that tells you with the Second World War is huge.
Yeah.
If you do like pure kind of like catalactic stuff, if you really just look at the way people interact and the way the kind of the emerging forces come out of this, or the, you know, supposedly emergent forces, removing motive from it, if you look at pure benefit calculations, it becomes quite horrifying that, you know, you have to believe that people are completely naive and uninterested to not think that maybe some of these people did this to Europe deliberately to benefit from it. But anyway, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves here.
Yes.
But we are kind of segueing into our next little section here, which is going to have a very big reading in it, I'm afraid.
That's okay. It needs it, and it's some good shit. It's some good shit.
We should probably do the second link before the first link, actually, if you want to read that one.
But
I think it actually leads in better.
So that's the betrayal.
Yeah. We need to obviously alternate with them, so I'll give a crack at that one. I think it starts where it says the old left in contrast. Again, we'll be reading from. We've just read from a couple of Mises articles and also Anthony Sutton's Wars and the Rise of Hitler. And now we're going to move to reading from Rothbard's Betrayal of the American Right, which is actually quite fascinating. It's something I would recommend people read because it's actually quite brief. But it's a great one, really, about how some of the post-war events really do show what happened. You know, and why it happened, and the idea that really that for a lot of the change that the left wanted to see, the Second World War was necessary for that change. There is really a need for war there to expand the size of the Leviathan. I know there's Christ and Leviathan, and I always forget the guy's name who wrote that. I don't have a copy of that. I can't find a copy of that, unfortunately. At least not for free, because I'm a broke ass nigga. But
same at the moment. Yeah. Hold on a second. So we're Betrayal of the American Right, chapter 6, page 54. Which is not where I'm at the moment. For some reason I'm at page 100 and something or other. So let me just
it's page 79 in the PDF. But
79 in the PDF. That right, okay, right. Yes. For the old left, in contrast, as it starts off. Let me eek.
There we go.
There we go. Let me transition that over to the screen so everyone can read along, so you can read along at home. For the old left, in contrast, World War II.
Robert Higgs.
Yes, Robert Higgs. You're absolutely right. Yes. Here we go. For the old left, in contrast, World War II was a glorious age, the fulfillment and the promise of a new dawn. Everywhere in the United States and in Western Europe, the liberal ideals of central planning, of a new planned order staffed by brain trusters and the liberal intellectuals, seemed to be the wave of the future as well as the present. In the colleges and among the opinion moulders, any conservative view seemed as dead and outmoded as the dodo, and confined to the dustbin of history. And no one was more pleased at this burgeoning New Deal collectivism than the Communist Party. Yep. Its new popular front line of the late 1930s, a line that had been replaced by its old harsh revolutionary views, seemed more than vindicated by the glorious New Order. Bjorning in foreign affairs, the United States was marching hand in hand with the Soviet Union in a glorious war to defeat fascism and expand democracy. Domestically, the communists under Earl Browder, as their leader, exulted in their newfound respectability. The Browderite line of arriving at socialism through ever greater and more centralizing the New Deal reform seemed to be working in a glorious fashion. The communists trumpeted that communism was the 20th century Americanism, and that they were the forefront of the new patriotism and of the super-identification with American Leviathan. Foreign and domestic communists played an exhilarating, if subordinate, role in the war effort, in planning war production, in giving orientation lectures to the armed forces, and calling for the persecution of all possible opponents for the war.
Yeah, he then goes on to talk about the fact that basically the American Communist Party were the people who stopped strikes during the war. They very much got in line with the American establishment and stopped organized labor. It's a great way of putting it, because basically what he's saying is that, and he said it, he even mentions the Leviathan by name, that the body of state is massively enhanced by both the New Deal and the Second World War. It is the culmination. You know, the Second World War is the fulfillment of all of this. Just like the First World War was the fulfillment of the Progressive Era, when he talks about the Progressive Era. It is this great kind of zenith of collectivism, that they have gone hand in hand with the communists, you know, that in this era, the communists, Stalin's communists, were the allies of democracy. Yeah. You know, the hammer of the East, you know, the iron hammer of Stalin.
Putting stop to organized labor movements as well is horrifyingly anti-communist in theory. That broke my brain to think
they were controlled. That the thing is, though, they were getting the collectivism that they wanted. They didn't want any. They didn't want organized labor rocking the boat.
No, because organized labor was mob run, always has been, always will be.
The first thing that any successful communist movement does is basically disband the unions.
Yes! Yes, they don't understand that. but of course, back in those days, the unions were, and still are now, kind of, as you said, mob run, which meant probably Italian mob in those days, which meant probably actually Mussolini fans, or at least sympathizers.
Not really, no. The Italian mob hated Mussolini. He went out and tried to smash them.
He did, but there was some positive. Yes, you are right. I know that. I know you're right in Italy certainly, but I know there was an awful lot of people that looked upon Mussolini very favorably in America, right up until the point where Mussolini joined with Nazi, you know, Germany. You know that they. If things had gone differently, if Mussolini hadn't done that and had held on, Mussolini's fascism would have probably been welcomed into the international community afterwards, if he'd survived it. Probably wouldn't have survived it, because the German war machine was horrific and the Italian war machine was laughable, to say the least. But they got beaten by the Ethiopians, after all. But yes. Italians were not communist. And yeah, this is, shall we, where am I? I've killed my flow.
Oh, that's the quote we needed from Betray the American Right anyway.
Yeah.
It is quite amazing that they essentially cracked the whip on the unions.
Yeah.
Because they want, you know, they saw themselves as being in for a future reward if they help with the war effort. It's really funny that everybody gets used by this, and that communists really are the ultimate useful idiots, even in their own movements. They did the whole thing in that, you know, they'll push FDR from the left, and eventually New Dealism has to become communism because that's where it's going. Or it has to become socialism. I mean, this is pre, you know, the American welfare state, which is massive. People don't think of America as a welfare state, but it is. It has a massive welfare bill.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
It is, in raw numbers, I think, the biggest welfare system in the world. I don't know, maybe China would say it rivals it, but China's a funny one because they really do not look after their own people. Because they already have all the control that they need.
I'm going to throw one out here that everyone forgets, but Saudi Arabia is a colossal welfare system. They've got something like sort of 70% of their population is on welfare and being paid for by the oil they pump out of the ground. I've said this before, the moment we stop buying oil off Saudi Arabia, we're going to have real problems with that country. Because their wealth is totally tied to it. It is a massive, massive welfare state. But not a democracy.
There's actually quite a large quote here that I want to read. Because basically, there's no other better place to put it, but this really sums up a large part of the series. And it's very dense language-wise, but I'm kind of annoyed how well this is put. Because it doesn't make us redundant. But if you understand a lot of the source materials that we reference, this will sum up a lot of the stuff we talk about when it comes to democratization. Because we're finally at, again, the time to read large sections from Leviathan Ascendance by Sam Francis.
It doesn't make us redundant. What we've done is we've allowed people to travel with us to this point so that they can get there without it just being clobbered with it.
Unless you've studied, like, you know, academic Marxism, and you've also studied, you know, someone like Burnham, and you've studied someone like Rothbard, this book will be gobbledygook to you, which I've tried to tell people. It is very much built on previous theory. But if you understand that theory, it is one of the most powerful reads you can have. But if trying to understand especially state power and the march of history towards kind of the managerialist class we have now, of this idea of the propagation of what is essentially socialism, ordered socialism, but like pound shop middle manager socialism, I always put it back. I'll just read the quote anyway. Again, Leviathan, its name is, I have a bit of a butchered PDF here. It's page 327 of the PDF. It will not be that in the book. I have a much better hard copy here that I use as reference. Track it down if you can, but it is expensive. The dematerialization of property and the replacement of the entrepreneurial firm as the dominant form of economic organization by the mass corporations and unions under the managerial control eroded both the economic power base of the bourgeois elite as well as the institutional roots of the bourgeois worldview. He uses bourgeois basically as old world, as the Victorian and 19th century and industrial revolution moneyed class, the old elites basically. The reorganization of the population from the particularized, localized, private and family and community-centered institutions of the bourgeois order into a massive, anonymous, highly mobile, homogenous and routinized disciplines of the managerial regime subverted the bourgeois worldview and the ideologies based on it by rendering its ideas and values irrelevant to the actual lifestyles of post-bourgeois groups. What he's referencing there basically is the accelerated, you know, industrialization after the Industrial Revolution. And that what happens is that people no longer live in communities. They no longer have private lives. They no longer primarily organize themselves as families. They think of themselves as countries, as classes, as political parties. They become this anonymous underclass mass, which allows them to be ruled more easily. The proletariat. Sorry, go on, Drew.
Sorry, yeah, I was going to say this is more so now than ever before as well. But yes, go on. I was just going to say that this is where we're where they're talking about there. We are there on crack at this point in time.
Yes. The proletarianization of the post-bourgeois social formations thus consists not only in the disappearance of economic and social autonomy through the erosion of hard property and independent ownership, but also in the cultural dispossession involved in the deracinating transformation provoked by the revolution of mass and scale and the dominance of managerial elites. That is a mouthful, but it's a perfect mouthful. Basically, again, what he's saying is that everyone who is under the managerial ruling class becomes this homogenized underclass. They end up, they don't own very much. They're not propertied. They don't understand economic independent ownership properly. They culturally are lost. They have this feeling that they don't belong. And deracinate is a great word. It means to be rootless. These people are rootless culturally. They don't have communities. They don't have families. They don't feel like they are part of anything outside of this anonymous new movement in which they must look to these managerialists. These new politicians, these parliamentarians, these federalists, they must look towards these people to give them meaning. And to, you know, the scale of the world to them has got so much bigger. Like I said, they no longer exist in their families. They exist in these massive managerial sovereign nations in which they are deliberately portrayed as a small cog in a large machine.
Yes, further deracination of Europe would be essentially to wipe out our history and just mention things that happened, but after changing the names of everything so that we could study the history but wouldn't be able to attribute it to any sort of national or even local pride. You would just be a person that lives in a place and stuff happened in the past. Deracination is the removal of the soul of the land.
Yes, it is. What he's basically saying here as well is that the Great Reset has been going on slowly since 1900.
Yes.
It's basically the fact of you know, you'll own nothing, you'll be happy. That has been changing. You know, people used to understand property rights because they had absolute property. They understood that that was inherently something you should have up until 1900, really. And then I'll just read the quote. The protracted duration of the transformation, extending from the late 19th century through the 20s and completed in the Depression and the Second World War, disguised its occurrence. And the distractions of the war and the return of mass affluence after softened the impact on the bourgeois order. He's describing what we have labeled here democratization.
Yeah.
He's describing the creation of the mass society and really the traumatic distraction of the two world wars. People wouldn't have accepted this, and it would have been too obvious without the wars. The wars become these great traumatic wounds of confusion on the populace, in that they will just basically accept a new reality after them because they have been so traumatized by them.
Angela Merkel refusing to wave the German flag on that stage is the perfect example of this. Just a statesman without a state that even despises any symbology of the state, doesn't want to know about it. They just rule over people. The state is a thing of the past to these.
Well, people. Nevertheless, the long-term result of the proletarianization of the middle class is the emergence of a separate, distinct, and increasingly alienated anti-managerial post-bourgeois social force with emerging structural interests and collective consciousness, neither bourgeois nor managerial, that consists of locus of residence to the soft managerial elite. As Mills noted in 1951, the structural position of the white-collar mass is becoming more and more similar to that of wage workers. We are, of course, propertyless, and their incomes draws closer to and closer together. All the factors of their status position, which have enabled white-collar workers to set themselves apart from wage workers, are now subject to decline. And Mills predicted that in the course of the next generation, a social class between lower white-collar and wage workers will probably be formed. That will not, of course, involve the professional strata or the higher managerial employees, but will include the bulk of the workers in sales room and office. It's describing what is, you know, it's the ruled and the ruler. It's the ruling mm-hmm. class and the ruled class. It is the, you know, the proletariat mass and the Soviet elite. Economically dependent on the mass organizations of the regime for their subsistence and affluence, post-bourgeois strata displayed little attraction to the bourgeois conservatism and its emphasis on laissez-faire economics, the rights of property, the minimal state, and the ethic of economic individualism. And the other tenets of bourgeois ideology centered on the defense of bourgeois economic and political interests. Again, this is why once you live in a world where you are not a property owner, you don't value property rights.
Yeah.
It's that simple. Like many people now, what we're talking about here, I've experienced it myself, they don't understand what you're saying because they live in a different world. They don't understand the world before this democratization and the creation of the mass state. It's worth pointing out that the idea of the mass state and mass culture in of itself is an invention of this period. We're going to have our own special on it because it does not fit anywhere. It's too big of a topic. But radio and then television are vital to this process. Pre-1920, really, outside of maybe records, outside of maybe 78s and shellac records, there was not mass culture. Mass culture, you know, outside of people who read novelization, did not exist in its current form. It's really worth bearing that in mind, that this whole process takes place both under the emergence of the managerial class, the emergence of the idea of mass democracy consciousness, but also the emergence of, you know, what would become known as monocultures, and then those would be smashed together into these global multicultures. Yes. This whole process is going on simultaneously, and to understand it, you must understand the fact that the two world wars were there either by design or taken advantage of as opportunities to traumatize people into accepting a new world in which, you know, they subsist as the managed to the manager.
It is, I mean, it's as you said, though, the record, and from the record, the TV, and from the TV to the internet, it is almost ironic that we are using a tool, the tool that will destroy it all. Yeah? The internet is the mass communication system that is their wet dream.
Yeah? The thing is, once you combine the ideas of Leviathan and its enemies with understanding how technology and mass culture affect you, you end up with Ted Kaczynski. Oh,
You good old Uncle. Yes, I need to read more Kaczynski because
do.
he seems to have a point or two.
The thing is, San Francis is on the edge of that. If you understand all this theory, if you have read all the Mises stuff, you've read Lenin, you've read Marx, you understand what the Marxists believe, you understand people like Bastiat and the law. If you're extremely well read and you read something like, if you read Leviathan and His Enemies, then you read like the collected works of Ted Kaczynski, like we have here. Again, we have a hard back copy of that here too. I don't want to get arrested for that, but you really, again, it's. I don't want to be all Rick and Morty, but it really is very cutting edge, out of the grasp of a lot of people understanding wise. It's you kind of have to be above a certain intelligence level to get it. You do.
Yep.
It's it really is almost it's a bit of a, again, it's a bit of a social, like, over socialization test, but it's also very much an, can you actually grasp these ideas? Can you combine all of this together into something that you can make it so you understand the world and go, oh, holy shit, yes, that's what's happened, and that we've had these emergence of these two events, one feeding off the other, and it has been an absolute disaster.
It's on a scale that may endanger the human race as a whole. Prior to this communication system, prior to all of this, a small town in, North Yorkshire would carry on being a small town in North Yorkshire, regardless of whether New York was having a bad spell economically. These days, New York has a bad spell economically, and the whole world fails it.
Oh yeah, it's the necessary interconnection between nations is, I don't know, it's something I think people overplay. But again, we're getting into a different topic. We'll probably have to expand on another time. But it's kind of cool how Leviathan and Its Enemies covers so much and covers so many of the implications of that you end up being able to talk about, like, you end up almost being led into the Kaczynski stuff. But I think we're losing people a bit here, so I'll get back on topic.
Good, because yes, I'm starting to want to clean guns again. Sharpen knives. Right, carry on. Yeah, where were we?
I'm that's all I wanted to read from that quote.
Okay, right,
I've gone on long enough anyway. I don't know, Trig. It's a big discussion though about the need for war, for state expansion.
The need
That,
for, yeah.
we don't end up with liberal democracy without mass death.
No, I know. Blood for the blood gods and all that. It really feels a little bit like that as well. It really does feel like we are the little guy is sacrificed en masse once again for this sort of for Slaanesh, essentially. I don't know where to. Well, it's horrific. It is the most horrific thing that has ever happened to the human race is the last 100 years. I've argued this so many times. The amount of times you run into people on social media that go on about religion. Oh, religion's terrible. Religious purges have cost so much life and death and so much death and throughout history and yada yada yada. And I can very happily, well, very not happily, but very easily just go, really, because quite frankly, the sacrifices and the slaughter of the last 100 years, pushing through a democratic system across Europe, and creating a godless society, that is the totalitarian and then non-totalitarian sort of political systems of Europe and the West, killed far more people. Far more people than any religious war, and any given. In fact, I would hazard a guess. If you counted up every single life lost from religious wars, from the countless sort of jihads and so on, I don't think it would come close to what has happened in the last 100 years in the service of communism, democratization, and liberalism, etc. The last 100 years has been horrendous loss of life. Compare that to the 10,000 people fought in a war here, and 20,000 people fought in a war here, and the freedom, the freeing of Vienna from the Turks, etc. Again, love, you know, the tale of the winged hussars. But again, you're talking a few thousand people every single time in comparison to the hundreds and hundreds of thousands and millions of people that die in the First World War, the Second World War, and all for the slathering, hand-rubbing, you know, machinations of Wall Street and the political elite.
It's really the only way they can keep the show going. It's quite an unnatural organization of human beings. This is where you know, I know you've been wrestling with it yourself, because it can be a bit hard to get your head around, but a lot of the natural law stuff, yeah. And you get into the idea of how humans, for the last 10,000 years, have wanted to organize themselves and have naturally tried to organize themselves. And mass societies like this very much violate a lot of the tenets of natural law, of what people would consider their natural rights to themselves, their autonomy, and their property. It is not compatible with many of the aspects of natural law, which is where, when you get into like the Hopper stuff as well, he talks quite heavily about natural law. But yep. Yeah, it's something we will cover next time as well, because we're not even getting to some of the worst of it. There's some even, you know, more harsh knowledges I would bring about the subsummation of mass death into the myth of the popular state of the body of people. Of the idea that these are, you know, it's I'll probably repeat this one again, but it's very Aztec human sacrifice. You know,
yeah.
The Second World War was the price we paid for, you know, a world of democracy. Well, again, that's really it, being framed as a battle of democracy versus dictatorship is a hand's tip towards the propaganda that is the narrative of the Second World War. That this is framed as this, you know, in order for it to be worthwhile, in order for you to agree with the events that took place during this period, you have to see it as an absolute battle between good and evil. And you have to see democracy and the idea that these are democratic powers as somehow really absolving them of the acts that they did during the war period. There's a speech that FDR made in which he talks about He talks about it a few times, but there's a very famous speech, I think in 1941, after Pearl Harbor. It talks about the arsenal of democracy.
Yes. Hold on, let me dig that up. I've got it right here. Is that right? Is that the Wikipedia article?
It's just the Wikipedia link, yeah, but okay. I just wanted to go through. Okay. We use it occasionally because I like to go through some of the popular history stuff. Some of the stuff that, you know, if you just Google World War II and you just Google its events, this is what a lot of the stuff you'll get. And a lot of it doesn't have to be, you know, stuff like San Francis or Mises or, you know, Anthony Sutton. You can just go over the events and say, this rhetoric is very strange.
It is, yeah. Somewhat worrisome. The loss of the individual. We are just meat for the grinder to these people. In fact, I'm going to dig this up. Whilst we're talking about this, I'm going to dig something else up, because I found an absolutely horrific comment by Henry Kissinger the other day.
Oh God, not Kissinger. Not the war criminal in chief.
Yeah, whilst we go through that, let me just find this, because when I was made aware of it, I was just ugh isn't the word, and it, hilariously, it's actually sort of rather reflective of the what's been going off currently, but yes, sort of here we go, the arsenal of democracy. Do I have that on screen?
You have it on screen.
Cool.
You have a dig for that. I'll go over this quite quickly.
Do. Find it now.
Yeah, it really was. Its impact and the impact of its rhetoric was to really make a big decline and almost defeat the isolationists and the people who were anti-war, the people who did not want interventionism because of the trauma of the First World War. Basically, after the First World War, the American people went, never again. We ain't doing that again. That was pointless. We were interventionists. That was Europe's war. And it needed to be reframed as democracy, which is a pure good, versus autocracy and totalitarianism, which is a pure evil. And in order to establish this, they must become the arsenal of democracy. That in being democratic, they are justified in being warlike. And in being democratic, they must support the allies of Europe. And in being democratic, you know, it's essentially democracy as a call of we are the good guys, which it has become ever since. It's what the Forever Wars became. It's the same rhetoric that was used in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's the same rhetoric that is still being used to try and intervene in places like Syria, that we are the forces of democracy, that we are the free world, and we are justified in taking action because we are democratic and because we are the free world. The actual facts of the matter, you know, aren't important. You know, we're democratic, and because we're democratic, what we do is right. That is the rhetoric that is used here, and it's the rhetoric that's used continuously post-war because it worked. People didn't really re-examine what was going on. People didn't examine the events. People didn't examine the fact that the size of the American state had ballooned tremendously under FDR when he was able to come in and do this and say, you know, American industry, and specifically government-led American industry, and the war economy itself was this great virtuous arsenal of democracy. And that they were going to, you know, use bombs and guns and death to spread freedom around the world. It's incredibly familiar rhetoric, but it's amazing how long it's worked for.
Yeah, it's. I know I've got it here, and I'm just. I want to dig up whether or not this is actually real. Before I'm going to say it anyway, but I take it with a pinch of salt at this point whether or not this is actually real, because it's so fucking horrific. I'm going to read it out. I'm going to pop it in the screen, actually, see if we can get it. Once the herd accept mandatory forced vaccination, the game is over. They will accept anything. Forcible blood donation or organ donation for the greater good. We can genetically modify children and sterilize them for the greater good. Control sheep minds and you can control the herd. Vaccine makers stand to make billions. And many of you in this room today are investors. It's a big win-win. We thin out the herd and the herd pays for us providing the extermination services. Now, what's for lunch, huh?
Dr. Henry Kissinger.
I hope it's not real. I was sent that yesterday.
Weird. That's like Conspira Boomer Facebook post.
It really is. But if that's real, I mean, you know what? I've got some Kissinger stuff. It's not a million miles from him, but please, by someone check out whether that's real, because if that's actually him. Well, he's already on the list. He's already on my list anyway.
No, I don't think that's a real one. Kissinger doesn't talk like that anyway. He's smarter than that.
You're right there.
So I don't think that's a real quote there, Trey.
Good. No, I'm glad. I'm glad if the people are actually speaking like that, it's horrendous. But yeah, no, that was. I hope not real.
Like I said, this is going to be a bit of a... I'm trying to divide these up into slightly more manageable episodes, to be fair. I don't want to slow the series down too much. But we have... You know, we usually have like 12 slides. We only got 5 today, but that's mostly because of how dense this subject is. But the big point I want to make with the whole arsenal of democracy is that all the rhetoric must come from a place that this is an existential battle between good and evil, which is how it's framed in the history books. That if you don't believe that the Western allies are purely virtuous, that this war and its slaughter becomes more like, you know, there's a lot of cope that goes on with the First World War, and people have defaulted to, well, it was a pointless war, and well, it was this, and, you know, it was disappointing, and it was a waste all around. People haven't got to the, this was a war imposed by these people, and we should be very mad at them. Especially when it comes to Wall Street. But the Second World War, again, it's some of it's softening. There has been some slight revision, as we talked about, especially with the Stalin stuff. But you can't question the idea. You know, there's the idea that the Second World War is the last truly virtuous war. And the idea that there are truly virtuous wars, especially in like a mass sense, unless they are, you know, direct wars of self-defense, is laughable. The idea that, you know, that there is a purely virtuous world war with a set good and evil side is, you know, it's children's logic. It's made for 7-year-olds. But yeah, it's really what you are taught, and it's really still, you know, the understanding of, you know, well, it's why people talk about the fact that, you know, well, Stalin was bad, but at least he defeated Hitler, and, you know, we talk about, well, X happened, but, you know, that was in service of freedom. This is still, again, we'll talk about this in the last section, but this is still really how the Second World War is portrayed. And for you to believe that it is a just war, you have to believe this first. That is how they get you.
Basically, that is, yes. I don't know, right? The World War did not end the Great Depression, is that right?
That's the last section, yeah. The war propaganda is historiography, which we can probably move on to now. If you want. Because I'm trying to make this a less than 2 hour stream, so we can do one next time.
Fair enough. Yes, it's probably a good idea, because the finishing at 12:30 is exhausting.
It's been necessary up until now because we've had so much to cover, but the Second World War is so big it needs to be broken down into much more manageable chunks.
There'll probably be
a very sizable one next week, because we'll be covering some more of the events. What we're really doing now is trying to reframe it. That's what this is. This is us trying to get you in the right frame of mind and get you in the right kind of, get you in the right mood, really, to understand some of the stuff we're saying. Because again, it really is a historical process of deprogramming almost when you're trying to untangle all these sources and all the lies and propaganda.
Yeah. Yeah. You will have to forgive me next week when we do that, because I can get my slightly sort of, I'm a big kid at heart. I love the stories of the Second World War. I love stories of Victoria Cross winners. I love the stories of the big battles and the technology that sort of was brought out by the Second World War. And when we start talking about the actual sort of the battles, the things that happen and get off, you know, yeah, well, I'll try not to fly off into, great about this, but...
We're doing this one because I don't think we could do just one... Even if we're doing the consequences of the Second World War, I don't think we can do just one stream about the war itself.
No.
You know, it kind of has to be almost three, to be honest. I was planning a consequences of, and then 1945 to 1950... And then a conclusion, because there's so much. This period is such a culmination of the things we've talked about before that we really need to take our time with it. And we will be interspersing other streams throughout as well, like we've been trying to do. I know these don't tend to get as many live views, but they get a lot of VOD views because people are working through the series, which I'm very grateful of. And I know I said a lot, but it's really amazing that people have come with us in this. And I see, you know, there's 1,000 people really that have watched each episode, metrics wise, there kind of must have been.
Yeah, and that's kind of wild.
It is. We've essentially delivered a series of lectures to a kind of university course sized audience, which for what we're doing and the size of the channel and the resources we're putting in is kind of amazing. So again, thank you guys for tuning into this. Thank you guys for listening, and thank you guys for bearing with us, because this, you know, this is not the usual entertainment content that people tend to consume. I'm quite surprised about how popular these have been. But yeah, there's a Mises article here which basically goes through a lot of the stuff to do with the myth that the World War II was the end of the Great Depression, and that, you know, the World War II was this great event that really brought economic stability to Europe. And there was prosperity after the war in the US, especially because of how much money they made out of it. But the real fact is that the crediting of both the New Deal and Roosevelt's leadership during the war for ending the Great Depression is kind of nonsense.
I was going to say, it left, the Second World War left the whole of Europe as a floundering mess. Sure, it might have been the end of the Great Depression for America, but Europe was crippled. England, I remember England in the 70s. We were not a wealthy country then. We were still rebuilding damage that had been done by the Blitz and so on in London. Places were still bombed out in the 1970s. We'd sent people, huge amounts of workers, over to Germany to help rebuild Germany after the war. And they were still there, sort of 30, 40 years on, still rebuilding parts of Europe that had been absolutely crushed by the Second World War. To say that the Second World War ended the Great Depression and that it was all, you know, wonderful and wealth afterwards is very American-centric, and it isn't even American-centric. It's just not true.
And the problem is it ended up with the perpetual war economy.
Yeah.
I'll read a little bit from here. It's down where it says the Great Depression did more than chill the investment climate. It's about not halfway down, but nearly there. Do you see what that is?
Investment climate. Hold on. Let me look for that.
It's in the World War II. Didn't. Yeah, there it is.
There we go. The Great Depression did more than chill the investment climate. In Crisis and Leviathan, Higgs argues that during a crisis, a ratchet effect produces net increases in government discretion that are not completely reversed after the crisis. No, they are certainly not. Things happen when the government intervenes. First, the bureaucracy naturally tends towards expanding its beyond its stated goals. Mission creep, if you would. Second, intervention alters incentives. That is, the creation of a bureaucracy to address some problem also spawns a rent-seeking pressure group with interests that will prevent reversion to the status quo ante. Yeah, I mean, we see this every single time. I mean, the passports are a nice temporary measure after this First World War. You know, temporary measure, there forever. The Patriot Act was a temporary measure after 9/11, etc.
The argument I would make, and the argument it makes here, that the Second World War didn't end the Great Depression. The Second World War completely remade the societies of the West into managerial pseudo-socialistic states. And you ended up with some of the surface problems of the Great Depression going away, but you ended up with massive, massive structural problems within all the economies of Europe, within all the societies of Europe, in which the control over the populace was expanded and the size of the state was expanded and the ideas in people's heads were narrowed in many cases.
Yes.
That you end up with some of the material problems of the Great Depression are nixed by the creation of these new societies by the Second World War. But so much of what we see today and the crumbling of what we see of just not being able to keep the circus going is a direct result of that. That, you know, essentially if you are a classical historian and you see the Second World War as curing the Great Depression, then surely there must be some acknowledgement that maybe the cure was worse than the disease in many cases. Even though we've acknowledged that the Great Depression was a consequence of the First World War and the subsequent credit expansion, you know, the war in Europe of the First World War ruined everyone. Everyone lost, you know, things were destroyed. It was destructionism. But out of it, there came a false boom.
The Great Depression was, it was a false boom and then a potential reset. The fact is that reset wasn't allowed to go through, and the Second World War then created war economies that then perpetuated the industrial military complex that we've all been warned so many times about, that then will never go away because it employs too many people. It creates too many wealth for a very powerful elite group that will then make sure that they lobby the hell out of the government to make sure that that government continues to rinse its populace via use of excessive taxation so that those few elites can keep on taking that money straight out of my pocket and your pocket.
Yeah, there's actually been another donation by Glowy. He's made a few. Thank you, Glowy. But makes a very good point. Thank you for the general donation. What I'm getting from this series is that we went from men and wars of honor and glory on necessity to man and wars of financial greed and manipulation.
Yes.
But it went further than that. We got into a situation where war is necessary to maintain the status quo. We have always been at war with Eurasia and all that. It's a situation where war is necessary for neutrality. War is necessary not to have a collapse, in that the only way to keep, you know, the charade going of something like the New Deal was to have a war.
Yeah.
It's almost the you went from wars of honor to wars of greed to wars of desperation because they didn't know what else to do.
Wars of desperation, yes, but as you say, the wars are necessary. The wars after the Second World War, the whole, oh, we've had nothing but peace since the Second World War. No, we haven't. We've had nothing but wars since the Second World War. Proxy wars left, right, and centre that have been weapons testing grounds, tactics testing ground, and you know, generally massacres of everyone involved, because it keeps your military-industrial complex going. That if you didn't need... You know, we the spending that goes into, you know, new jet fighters, new tanks, new military technology. If that wasn't necessary because no one was looking towards war and building towards war, that's... I mean, what is it? What is America's annual spending? It's like $500 billion a year? I mean, okay, it's only twice as much as England's spending on the NHS. But even so, it's a colossal amount of money. When people go, oh, if we stop spending X amount on military, we could feed all the homeless and do... Literally. But more importantly, that's coming out of people's pockets.
You couldn't. What's happening is that the American military budget is a massive government a continuous government stimulus to the American economy.
Yes.
Most of that money doesn't go towards anything frontline. Everyone points this out, but they don't understand that what they're doing is they are doing job creation. That money funds well-paid technical jobs. What they are doing is creating good employment for people with government money. And people don't look at it that way. The American industrial military complex is a socialist endeavor.
Yes. it's literally Keynesianism in action. It is, we need to stimulate the economy, therefore we're going to create public works.
It is a continuous trillion-dollar direct stimulus to the domestic American economy that needs to happen for America not to collapse.
But every single year it just adds to the budget deficit. It's akin... constantly kicking the can down the road, and every time you kick that can, it gets bigger. Somebody eventually is going to get clobbered by a very large boulder that was a
very large can. Yes.
Yeah.
It's a big ass can.
Yeah, yeah, and just every year gets bigger. I mean, have you seen the budget clock, the budget deficit clock thing that runs, that just sits there spinning up and up and up in numbers, and it's just the amount of money involved in that is mind-boggling. It's close to...
It's ridiculous, but yeah, I actually picked this one because we get to talk a little bit about High Christ and Leviathan and Higgs, which has been sorely missing from this, because it's kind of a vital one to read.
Yes.
It's one of the big gaps here, I will say, but yeah, the Ratchet Effect we talk about, it's stuff that I don't want to get at Higgs, because he's collected some stuff, but if you read all the stuff around it and the source materials, what Higgs is saying becomes almost obvious. That you need these crises to keep, you know, the Leviathan functioning.
Yeah.
And that one feeds into the other. But yeah, the Second World War is the ultimate example of crisis and Leviathan.
Do you want to carry on with that? Because where were we? We'd got to the status quo ante.
But
it goes on to Roosevelt's advisors saw that in this program not merely a road to recovery, but an opportunity to remake society. In FDR's folly, Jim Powell, echoing an idea advanced by Milton Friedman, suggests that they never appear to have considered the possibility that more power would magnify the harm done by human error or corruption. Their intellectual approach was to contrast actual capitalism with its ideal government, with intervention judged not on the basis of its effects, but on its intentions. Further, the intellectual program of the New Deal was consistent was inconsistent and often contradictory, Powell argues, that pragmatism and political expediency ruled the day. Yeah.
Yes. It is. There's also the issue that I can't remember who said it, and I have it in my notes buried somewhere, but there's this concept that people only see the result, they don't see the waste when it comes to things like public property and public works. And this idea of, oh, you know, they built this $3 billion bridge, but you don't see, you know, what the other $3 billion could be used for in a market sense. And you don't see the fact that a private company could have made the same bridge for $500 million. All people see when it comes to, especially like monopoly government spending, are the results of that. They don't see, you know, they don't know what could have been done without it, and the onerous effect it has on the economy. Again, it's results oriented thinking. They're not able to understand reality outside of the almost predetermined idea that, you know, well, this is how it is, so this is how it must be. It's something I repeat, but, you know, reality is what we make it, and we could very easily make it something else. And people don't think about that when they see, well, the government's given us this, the government's given us that. It's like, you might have those things, or you would have those things anyway, and probably cheaper, and you probably wouldn't have to trade rights for them either. And again, it's a very hard thing for to get people to think about, because all they see is the fact that, you know, they have all these great things given to them by you know, the state. All these people in America thought, wow, FDR had an amazing job with the New Deal, but what they didn't see behind the scenes was the incredible waste and the incredible concentration of power. And really that, again, is the propaganda of collective action during the Second World War has persisted. It has become our historiography. It was become almost our normality that we exist in this post-war collectivist era. And the propaganda of the Second World War has become our reality. That is how we view it. We view it through the lens of the war propaganda. The war propaganda is reality to a lot of people, which is kind of alarming. That they base their judgments and their worldview and their, you know, some parts of their self-identity when it comes to like the Churchillian myth, which I'll talk about next time, on lies, on propaganda, and on propaganda of people who perpetrated essentially a mass atrocity to bring about an increase in their own power.
Of course. It's the best way of doing it. I think we just had another donation from Glowy. I do like the fact that we are, whilst being very, very anti-establishment, shall we say, are highly funded by Glowys.
Yes.
yeah, no, nice one. Thank you. Thank you again, Glowy. You are an absolute legend.
Well, there's another section I want to read before we finish, because it's getting a little bit, not long in the tooth, but I do want to make these slightly shorter streams now.
Yes.
There's another section of Leviathan and its enemies I want to read, specifically about the Second World War, because I think it, again, it brings this whole kind of like the permanence of the Second World War's reality in our post-war reality to us. He first of all talks about, I don't read that in general, but the people who worked on the Versailles settlement were the Council of Foreign Relations, and they were made up of a huge amount of elites. The Council of Foreign Relations was not merely a group of concerned citizens committed to international activism. By the 1950s, it was heavily dependent on financial contributions from the large managerial corporations. Specifically, J.P. Morgan and the J.P. Morgan Company.
Oh, not them again. It's always fucking Jean-Pierre Point Morgan and that goddamn okay, yeah, carry on. Don't let me. I will just mutter about J.P. Morgan and how the world would be a better place without them ever in existence to myself, quietly.
Yeah. He, J.P. Morgan, has never made any real effort to conceal his position in regards to the Council on Foreign Affairs. The list of officers and boards of directors are printed in every issue of Foreign Affairs and have always been loaded with partners, associates, and employees of the J.P. Morgan Company. The British counterpart to the CFR was the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which was the creation of a group centered around Alfred Milner, who quickly noted was an early example of what James Burnham would call the managerial revolution. Although the Morgan interests properly belonged to a large-scale financial capitalism preceded managerial oligopoly, they underwent much of the same process of organizational enlightenment and the separation of ownership and control that precipitated the managerial revolution in non-financial enterprises. And the Morgan Bank was particularly influential in instigating the managerial revolution in the economy by installing professional managers with no property stakes themselves in the enterprise, writes Darren Bell, unable therefore to pass along their power automatically to their sons, and unaccountable to outside controllers, the banks effected a radical separation of property and family. So the internal structure of things like investment banks directly affect the way post-war organization happened. They created this class of managers who do not, you know, they have no skin in the game. Mm-hmm. They're these people who, you know, we talk about now who don't have shares in the company and, you know, they get big bonuses. It's essentially, you know, you can go a straight line from here to 2008. They don't have a property stake. They are not landowners. They are not dukes, you know, they are not aristocracy.
No.
And that makes them more dangerous because they aren't thinking about their family and they aren't thinking long term. They are professional managers. And it's amazing to think that that was not something that we used to have. Professional managers is an invention of people like the JP Morgan company because it is so powerful. These people are under their yoke and they are, again, it is the separation of property and family. It's something that Hopper talks about when he talks about de-civilization, that, you know, the people who were in charge used to have so much self-interest in preserving the integrity of a country because they were primarily landowners and hereditary landowners.
Yeah.
They weren't thinking about next year's bonuses. They were thinking about their grandchildren being able to grow corn on their land.
This is exactly right, though. It's not a tangent. It is pointing back towards the fact that almost the aristocracy and feudalism had a sense of permanence and respect and care for the land and those that lived on it that you do not have anymore.
Well, at least the incentive structure was that way.
Yes. I mean, it didn't always work out, sure. Without a doubt, there were... Feudalism was not as great as some people might romanticize about it, but yeah.
Yeah. The business interests represented in the Council of Foreign Affairs have therefore been almost exclusively managerial or closely related financial capitalist interests, and the intellectuals and political leaders associated with it have usually been drawn from the managerial intelligentsia of large universities and foundations and have represented managerial interests in government. The international activism of the CFR towards and sustained between 1919 and 1945 was thus largely an expression of the organizational interests of the managerial elite. Commercial intercourse with the Soviet Union, free trade, and the coordination of international commercial and financial relations reflected the global interests and operations of the managerial elite in mass corporations. The expansion and coordination of international political, economic, and military power reflected the interests of the elite of the managerial state, and the activism of state and corporations on a global scale created increasing demand and rewards for the verbal and technical skills of the managerial intelligentsia. Basically, what he's saying is that foreign policy in Europe and foreign policy in America just so happened to align with the interests of J.P. Morgan and its associated companies. And that what happened between 1919 and 1945 with trade with the Soviet Union, with international, you know, arms buildup, with the elite and mass corporation, the expansion of international capital, was really just an extension of the policies of people like the J.P. Morgan company. You end up with essentially governments becoming structures like JP Morgan. It mirrors exactly the interests of these managerial companies who create these non-landed elites and these non-landed, you know, managers. It's power, you know, without family responsibility and soil, really. You know, not to get too blood and soil there, but it is. It's a removal of man from culture, land, and family into a position of middle management. And yeah, that is not just reflected in companies, but in societies. And that is not something that's an affectation of the free market. It's something that's an affectation of the state.
Yes. Again, deracination.
Yes.
It's a beautiful... It's a good word, that one.
It is.
Yes.
Sorry.
Managerial
intelligentsia. Ideological themes associated with progressivism and cosmopolitanism, world peace, human progress, human rights, and international community also reflected those interests and contributed to the expansion of the managerial state through its global activism and foreign policy. The end of the Second World War, which James Burnham called the first great war of the managerial society, brought the soft managerial regime of the United States an effective global hegemony. the sudden acquisition of global power confronted the managerial regime with the challenge of assimilating and organizing it. Persistent bourgeois force in American political life expressed skepticism about the prospects of continued internationalism and the erosion of national sovereignty that such global power would involve. And those forces resisted policies, treaties, and legislation that drew any country out of its isolationism into the transnational communities of the new regime. So bourgeois resistance to globalism joined with managerial need to assimilate global power to facilitate consolidation of the hegemony of the managerial regime and the establishment of the instruments of preserving and organizing it. The United Nations and Bretton Woods Agreement, NATO, and similar transnational structures provided a machinery for preserving and extending the managerial global dominance and moving away from traditional concepts of the self-sufficient sovereign nation-state, conducting a foreign policy in according with its own national interests. Sorry, I had to read that whole thing because it's amazing, because it basically sets up the Second World War is necessary and responsible for globalism. Yep. And the Second World War is necessary and responsible for the interests of the state-aligned capital firms like J.P. Morgan. It's, I don't know, again, these two quotes are both amazing because they sum up so much stuff.
They do. It's really well put as well.
It is, yeah. It's quite densely put, and you have to understand the language, and you basically have to go on the journey we've been on, but we're here now, and this is what happened, and this is what was done to society when you handed over your power to managers through voting.
I mean,
the aspect that this doesn't have, which I think is important, is that these managerialists are empowered by mass democracy. That is how they gain their legitimacy. That is how they gain their power. Like they do in a corporation, it's seen as fair. They are seen as, and the technocrats too, are the same way.
Mm-hmm.
They are seen as, well, I'm the best man for the job. I did all the rituals. I respect the corporate culture. And then you have the people who voted in. They said, I represent the will of the people. And those people come together to form this managerial class who end up creating a world in their own image that is terrible. They end up creating this extended kind of branch of J.P. Morgan as a global hegemony.
You know, it's crazy. I hated J.P. Morgan a lot. I've always been a big fan of Nikola Tesla, and I learned to hate J.P. Morgan because of the way that J.P. Morgan and Edison fucked with Nikola Tesla to the point where they basically drove him into poverty and depression. And that's where I started out with J.P. Morgan. But every single time I read, it's just a continuous story of this is the worst person and the worst organization that has ever existed. Just about. I mean, literally worse than Hitler.
It's something that people don't think about, but modern corporate culture reflects off and feeds off the modern corporate state. And that what makes people unhappy about quote-unquote capitalism was put in place by central planned authorities. And that the world we live in, with how much power these governments have, is purely shaped by that power.
Yeah.
That, you know, they are not omnipotent. They are not all powerful. They are inefficient. But because of our belief in their power, they have created the world in which we live. And a large section of doing that was through an event like the Second World War or the First World War. And you have to, something I would drill into people as they watch this is that the only way that these people took power and the only way that you end up in a situation of a mass democratic, modern liberal state is through mountains and mountains of death.
Yeah, literally mountains of death. I mean, you can look at the killing fields of Cambodia and multiply that by a couple of million.
Well, there's a concept as well that I want to wheel out for a while, because it might make a lot of people mad if they eventually get around to watching this and don't like me. But we have the whole death toll of communism. But really, the Second World War and the First World War and a lot of the events thereafter can be chalked up to the death toll of democracy.
Yeah.
These are liberal democracies and these are how they conduct themselves, then that is the emergent, the emergent fault of the system. If the, if their rulers really are instilling the will of the people and this democratic system is what brings about these results by functioning, then this is the democratic death toll. If the Second World War is a war for democracy, then the death toll is a death toll for democracy. And whether you know, whether you believe that or not, following its own logic, democracy must be an end goal that is so laudable that it deserves and is worth all those deaths. And if you don't believe that, if you don't believe that millions of people should die so you can put a piece of paper in a box that may or may not ever be counted or influence policy, you should probably re-examine doing action outside of that system, because, you know, you have essentially been duped. You've been sold a bill of goods that is not true. And you've been sold a bill of goods that is predicated on the idea that millions of your fellow men need to die occasionally for it to be perpetuated.
Yeah. Funny how it's never the sons and daughters of the wealthy elite that say that these people are going to die that go out and die, though, is it? Whatever happened to the royals leading the front of the charge of their armies? I mean, you know, when are we going to see Tony Blair's son charging the lines of a castle? Or yes. You know, it never happens. It never happens.
A lot of people accuse us of being blackpilling in these streams, but I think that you need to understand the power of knowing, you know, knowing what we know, understanding what we know, and going through this process, because it means that you are not essentially a victim of the mind virus of democracy and the mind virus of, you know, the belief in the omnipotent power of the modern state. The modern state is only, you know, omnipotent. As Mises, you know, omnipotent government, omnipotent state kind of thing. If you believe it is, it is the belief in it that makes it omnipotent. If enough people simply do not believe in the power of the state, it stops existing. It is a being of belief. You know, they quite literally they would have to put a policeman in not in everyone's home, but in everyone's head to truly enforce the hegemony of the modern managerial state. And yeah, and Plasma Rob's right, it's a white pill that we live in this time that is a great opportunity, because a lot of this stuff is crumbling around us. And in understanding the systems are put in place and seeing outside of our time period and using, you know, this very powerful historical knowledge, we are in much better placed than a lot of people around us to be able to affect change. It's not the fact that, you know, look how terrible it is that this has been done to you. It's once you understand that this has been done to you, you can begin to change things. And I don't think we'll get to that part eventually, you know, the systems that come next, what comes next, what do we want to do, what do we actually, you know, want to enact in terms of change. These are the things we haven't laid out yet, but we have to go through the process of demolishing the false history and showing people how, you know, their democratic vote is predicated on expanding the power of people that they should hate, and if they understood all the things about them, they would hate. That is really the process I want to take people through, and it's a process I have taken, you know, thankfully a few people through who've been very hungry for the knowledge. But it's something I'm hoping to do in person occasionally with people, and I know it becomes quite esoteric if you've never seen this kind of stuff before. But again, you will be empowered, I think, to affect change better by knowing these things. And I know these things are sometimes quite terrible. And a lot of people, you know, it is a bit of an undeniable logic if you understand that the literature and you understand the process and you understand history, it does become a bit overwhelming sometimes. But, you know, you are, I think, much better placed to be able to change things if you understand, you know, kind of what the communists refer to as the false consciousness.
Oh, we've had a few more. I've heard the ding. I've been looking elsewhere.
It's all Glowy. Spam.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Glowy.
He did mention Nikola Tesla, and I know you read that one. Thank you for that one.
Yes.
Yeah, it would explain why regulations and restrictions came about. Yeah, stop him from getting power. Teddy Roosevelt was one of those that fought on the front lines. He also fought against corporations. But how much of this is true? Yeah, the thing is, Teddy Roosevelt, as we talked about at the beginning of this series, is largely a mythical figure. He's a product of his own marketing in many ways. He's got that, as we talked about, that Trumpian thing about him, but he's difficult to untangle because he was someone who was in league with, again, the J.P. Morgan Company. That's how they got a lot of their power, because Teddy Roosevelt was able to pick the winners and the losers in his progressive era. And really his chauvinism and his semi-corruption, you know, in a self-serving marketing way, is what paved the way for someone like Woodrow Wilson, who was just outright fucking evil.
Oh, it's all so fucking outright evil, dude. It really is. I'm being called out for quoting System of a Down, which not exactly, but yes. I can get a bit, you know, if we're going to talk.
It's BYOB is actually kind of an incredibly based song. So is actually some of the Slipknot stuff, weirdly enough. There's like a whole bunch of stuff in the mid 2000s. Basically, like, about not dying in the Forever Wars, which is actually pretty good.
Yep.
It is also tiresome. Anyway, this is just the first part of our Second World War stuff. Is there anything you want to talk about, Trigg, before we sign off?
No, I think at this point in time, I'm good. Without going off onto a rant about how evil J.P. Morgan is, I am good. I'm looking forward to next week's one, because we have so much more to do on this.
We do, yes.
But also, I will say that if we are living in a cyberpunk dystopia, we are all better off being rocker boys than anything else. Going back to screaming into a microphone about how fucked up the corpos are and the politicians are, and how they, if they want to fight the wars, they should get into the fucking die themselves rather than send us. Then yeah, fuck them. anyway, sorry. I am angry, but not at the moment. People are messaging about AA's IRL event. I am not going to be there. I know you're going to be there. I thought we'd
I will be there. It's the Shieldings event. I don't know. It's quite expensive, to be honest. But
yes, we also have something coming up in the very near future, which I think we're gonna market a little more. You've put
A video out there. I don't want to market too much yet, because we don't have a venue properly. We're still venue shopping,
and don't have any topics,
we don't have all the details ironed out. The next thing we need, which we're going to try and get tomorrow, is a ticket store.
Yeah,
I'm going to try and get some early adopter tickets out there, and I will be frank and honest with people that those tickets are what we're going to use to pay for the deposit. So we are trying to basically build a little, you know, a little bit of resilience financially into it, but we're not trying to turn a profit, honestly, on the first one. You can only ever hope to break even on these things.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
No,
I mean, break even, you know, pay for a good piss up with us and friends and like-minded people. Good. And people are now saying we need a forum for this YouTube channel, and whether it should be not a Reddit site, please.
I do have the Discord. I mean, the Discord works.
Do we want to open the make another Discord for it? We're not don't let them into our little Discord thing.
The Discord's fine. it's linked down below. You can join the Discord.
Fair. Yes. Okay. Okay.
Anyway,
yeah.
I will sign off now, Trigg.
Cool. I think it's time to do that, and I'm gonna. I haven't eaten anything all day. I'm gonna go and make myself.
Eat something.
I've been. Oh, I've got to tell you about this. What I've been doing is I've been making smash burgers. Do you know smash burgers?
No.
You basically get a normal sized meatball, right? You get.
All I can think of is, like, you know, remember the powdered mashed potato?
Yeah. No.
Smash.
No. Right. Brioche bun, yeah, you get a couple of meatballs, decent sized meatballs, and you get a grill pan, you get it going nice and hot, and you squash the meatball flat, so it's a very, very thin smashed burger. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, you cook it, you flip it over, so it's and then when you flip it over, you put a cheese slice, and you do like two or three of them, and then you stack them up into a brioche bun, and it's just amazingly bad for you.
That's like a stack of burger sliders. Oh my god, that's like getting the core out of like 10 White Castles and stacking them together. That's awful.
Yeah,
I'm gonna stop streaming now before you actually give me heart disease over the internet.
Ah, cool. Well, good night, everyone, and yeah, see you
Yes.
later.
See you later.